Well, hello, everyone. Mike Volkoff here for Corruption, Crime, and Compliance. And we thought we'd take another check-in with Scott Greytak from Transparency. And we've got him joining him today is Nate Sibley from the Hudson Institute. But these are our two sort of on top of it anti-corruption fighters in a difficult era. And we appreciate you guys joining us today to sort of bring us an update on what's going on in these issues and what are the sort of hot button issues that we see happening over the next year. So, Scott, great to see you again. Nate, great to see you as well. And just take a moment and Scott, go first, if you don't mind, and introduce yourself, just your background. And Nate, same as if you could do that as well. Thanks.
Thanks, Mike. Great to be with you guys today to talk about these updates. So I'm Scott Greytak. I'm the Deputy Executive Director for the U.S. Chapter of Transparency International, or TI. TI is the oldest and largest anti-corruption network in the world. We're in about 115 countries. And we've been really squarely focused in the United States on fighting illicit finance, which is the method by which corrupt politicians from around the world use to help get away with their corruption crimes by laundering their money into the United States and through the U.S. financial system. So great to be with you today.
Likewise, thrilled to be joining you today. Thanks for having me. I'm Nate Sibley, and I'm the director of the Kleptocracy Initiative, which is a project at the Hudson Institute, which is a nonpartisan think tank sort of focused on foreign policy, national security issues, based in Washington, D.C. And the Kleptocracy Initiative looks at the threat posed by transnational crime and corruption emanating really from US, major US adversaries, so China, Iran, Russia, Venezuela a bit, those sorts of places, and how they both use corruption to entrench and extend authoritarian rule domestically, but also increasingly use corruption and crime as tools of foreign policy as well, and what the US can do to stand up for itself in an increasingly dangerous environment.
That's great. Thanks, guys. It's good to have you both here. When we look across the landscape in terms of what's going on in the United States, you know, we've obviously had, you know, sort of a reorientation of the FCPA prosecutions and the SEC. But that doesn't mean that there aren't many other issues to focus on. And it's clear that there was a lot of interesting work that was going on years, you know, for the last few years. And one of those sort of trumpeted areas was the Corporate Transparency Act. And Scott, if you can sort of fill us in and Nate, what's going on with that? I know there have been court challenges, there have been legislative challenges, you know, in terms of tinkering with it and making sure there are strong forces, I think, that want to make sure it's restricted in application.
Yeah, I'm happy to start here, Michael. I mean, the long and winding road of the implementation of the Corporate Transparency Act, it's really the story that never stops giving, unfortunately. But long story short, you know, after over a decade of folks campaigning to get this across the finish line, the Biden Treasury began implementing the CTA. As recently as this past February, the Trump administration, when coming into office, was also defending the Corporate Transparency Act in federal court. There were about a half a dozen lawsuits that were filed, mixed results in the lower federal court levels on, you know, the constitutionality of the Corporate Transparency Act. But the Trump administration was saying much of the same arguments that the Biden administration was in court. This was an important national security, anti-money laundering, anti-corruption reform, you know, essential to protecting the U.S. financial system, et cetera. Now, unfortunately, in the middle of all the, you know, DOGE happenings, through a frankly very bizarre set of circumstances where a comedian tweeted Elon Musk and Elon about the Corporate Transparency Act being arguably bad for small businesses, Elon Musk tweeted back that he was going to look into it, and within 48 hours, the U.S. Treasury had put out a statement saying that they were going to not only suspend the enforcement of the Corporate Transparency Act against the, you know, 34 million companies that would have been covered by it, but that they were going to exempt basically 99.9% of those companies from any future reporting requirements. So really, without question, gutting this law that Congress intended to cover, you know, and abolish all the anonymous shell companies that were allowing dirty money to move into the United States. At the same time, you saw a lot of momentum picking up in Congress around what they called the Repeal the Big Brother Overreach Act, which would totally strike the CTA. They had, you know, at this point, it's almost 190 sponsors in the House, all Republicans. It's got 34 sponsors in the Senate, also all Republicans. Fortunately, our champions and defenders in Congress, which have been Republicans as well as Democrats, have been able to keep that bill from getting any time on the floor and moving forward. So that's really good news at this point, but we're still sitting in limbo. As you know, the CTA is effectively paused, gutted, and its future remains uncertain. Nate, I'll kick it to you if you want to build off of that, but that's sort of the 101 on where we are at the CTA.
Yeah, sure. Just to add a couple of things. It's worse than just sort of suspending the implementation, gutting it. They're also announced they're deleting all the beneficial ownership information that had been submitted by small businesses to date that had taken the time to comply with this important national security law. So it's kind of disappointing. At the same time, I think, you know, a set of circumstances came together around sort of crunch time for CTA implementation last year in January, which was really unfortunate. You know, the deadline was right on during, you know, the end of the holidays, January 1st. A bunch of the lawsuits that the lobbyists on the other side had launched were really well timed. And so you had this stop start of different courts across the country placing stays on it. Then they would allow it to proceed. And it was all just incredibly confusing for poor small business owners who were trying to comply with it or didn't want to comply with it and were trying to figure out if they had to. And so it became very unpopular, I think, in many quarters. And it's very, very easy to portray this as an example of overregulation, of overreach, hence the name of the legislation that would repeal it. But in fact, you know, it's actually very hard to make a succinct case, you know, in our sort of fast-paced, soundbite social media age. It's a piece of legislation that is quite difficult to kind of make to communicate the value of it to people who don't necessarily, you know, that aren't engaged in terrorism financing or anti-money laundering. So, you know, we're back to the drawing board somewhat, but I think it also taught the rest of us a lesson that we need to try even harder to try and communicate the basic reason why this is in place, which is not that we expect criminals to declare that they own shell companies. It's a really important, you know, piece of the jigsaw for law enforcement agents who are pursuing very complicated cases through the financial networks around the world. And, you know, sometimes a correctly filed thing can be a clue. The absence of a filing can be a clue, or if something looks awry with a filing, that could also be a clue. That's how it was going to be used in practice. And I think, you know, I've already taken a few minutes to explain even just that aspect of it, let alone before we get onto all the different bad actors that use it and how they are going to use it. So I think the challenge going forward is really to streamline and improve our communications and sort of, it was already a huge coalition behind it, but it obviously needs to be a little bigger, and we need to do a lot more education around this issue as it moves forward.
Yeah, you know, you guys both raise an interesting issue because, look, if you take a step back, when, for example, we represent clients and we're trying to do due diligence on companies and structures, and people don't want to deal with third parties who may be high risk third parties, and you know, the U.S. has been behind many other countries in terms of this disclosure kind of requirement. And I thought we were over the hill on that, or over the hump, or whatever you want to say. I am over the hill, but I get that. But it used to be the only place you could hide your company would be like in the British Virgin Islands, BVI. But now what started to happen as other jurisdictions outside the United States started to tighten up some of these rules, it becomes even more important, in my view, for the United States to you know, fulfill the CTA and what it was going to do. Nate, your point about, you know, it's hard to sell this thing in a soundbite, but it really has a significant impact for law enforcement and for intelligence and, you know, investigators. And, you know, I don't have to try to sell the wisdom of it, but, you know, in this world right now where we're focused on national security issues that relate to some of these corporate structures, you know, tying it to, let's say, Russia, to North Korea, to Iran, it's even more important. And I thought we were all in agreement on it. And I thought the rule was designed in a way to minimize the burden on everyone. But it just has been caught up in a campaign of misinformation, is what I feel.
There's no question about that, Michael. I mean, if you even type in beneficial ownership reporting, probably the first half a dozen responses on Google are going to be companies that are either charging fees or companies that are redirecting you to misleading websites, because, you know, most, there's a lot of information out there that says this costs money to report, or, you know, it's misleading about who's covered and especially what the penalties are if you don't report. I mean, one of the biggest talking points for the opposition here has been, you know, the average Joe's Pizza, if they just don't file, if they don't ever hear about this requirement and they never file a report, are going to be facing jail time for doing that. And that's just not the case. You have to willfully, so knowing that you have the law, knowing that you have to do this, and then you intentionally decide not to follow the law, that's the only time you could be held liable. And, you know, that fear factor, as Nate said, all the confusion amongst the lawsuits. I mean, the law was started and then stopped, and then a court would intervene, and then a higher court would overturn it, and the Supreme Court even got involved to a small extent eventually. All of that has just created this landscape that's confusing folks, and so they can't see the true value of this law. Like Nate says, I mean, it's national security, but think about what we're doing now with tariffs and trying to stop fentanyl trafficking into the United States. I mean, at the same time that you've got one end of the White House going full speed at trying to stop Mexican drug cartels and the you know, Chinese suppliers of fentanyl prerequisite drugs, you've got another side of the building saying, we're not going to go after these anonymous companies that we know are used to carry out these drug trafficking organizations. So there's really a disconnection that's going on. And I hope at the end of the day, our law enforcement champions, our national security champions, will be able to make clear to this administration why this is part and parcel of defending, you know, public safety and national security.
Yeah. Any closing comments on this, Nate? In terms of where you think this is going to go, or what do you think? I mean, to me, if law enforcement has to be a strong advocate in it and give examples of how this is critical, you know, to their uncovering these networks that you were just talking about, Scott.
Yeah, I mean, I think you guys have covered it pretty well, but I mean, in terms of where we go next, I do think, you know, right now, I think it would be foolish just kind of, you know, re-implement it overnight and demand everyone file straight away. I think there's a lot of bad feeling. I think we need a little time for it to kind of gurgle along and people to get, you know, to come back with a better plan of implementation, better timing, you know, give people time to sort of get used to the idea. Because as Scott said, there's so much disinformation flying around about it. You know, that it's going to cost the earth. It doesn't cost anything. You know, that it takes hours and hours. If you're owner of a mom and pop shop, it takes, I've seen the filing process. It takes like, you know, about 3 or 4 minutes to type in your name, address, an identifying number. That's basically it. And click submit. And you file and forget. You never have to, it's not an ongoing requirement, is what people forget. You know, so the argument should really be on our side. I think we could do a better job of adapting those arguments to talk to, to appeal more to the concerns of Americans outside the Beltway, national security, foreign policy, you know, the kind of arguments, a lot of the arguments are being made around it to do with Russian oligarchs using shell companies and so on and so forth. These don't really connect with people like, you know, out in the middle of the country who don't really have to deal with those problems in their day-to-day lives. But the sad thing is, you know, they're also the first victims of this because, you know, the vast majority of like shell company abuse is not by Russian oligarchs. It's by drug dealers. It's by petty fraudsters who are ripping off small businesses. And so, you know, I think we need to sort of come back with a better plan of attack, basically.
Yeah. Let's switch to one other area that I think, well, actually, I'm going to lump them together. And we've had a lot of, you know, talk about investment advisory, investment advisors, due diligence requirements, AML rules, and we've also been talking about the real estate industry for obvious reasons, you know, given AML rules applying there as well. These two areas just seem to me, or industries, however you want to, or whatever, seem to me to be important to focus on. And yet we've seen, you know, this IA investment advisory rules have been sitting there for a while and we still, they're not effective, but they may be subsumed by other events. But, and where are we, you guys, with respect to the real estate industry? Because if there's any industry that's clearly involved in money laundering, it's going to be in real estate.
Nate, you want to start us off?
Oh, yeah, so what you're talking about, Michael, these were the rules that were developed under the, I think it's both of them under the previous, the Biden administration, that would bring the investment advisor sort of sector and also the real estate sector within the purview of U.S. anti-money laundering laws. So like banks and other people who handle client funds, they would be required to maintain anti-money laundering programs, to do sort of risk-based assessment, everything proportionate, you know, to the risk that their activities pose in terms of money laundering. So, you know, a self-employed real estate agent living, you know, out in Iowa somewhere is probably not, you know, a huge concern in terms of, you know, billions of dollars being laundered into U.S. real estate. But some of the big firms in Miami, for example, and New York might well be. So everything's proportionate. The other thing they have to do is, monitor client transactions and report any suspicious activity to the Treasury in a very sort of confidential sealed system, you know, which is only accessed really in the course of other investigations. So it's a pretty simple ask considering when you think about the size of the investment advisor industry, it's hundreds of billions of dollars. New real estate, it's trillions of dollars that's floating around. Really, with no the participants in those industries have no responsibilities currently beyond not actively and knowingly being involved in a money laundering scheme. You know, they have no responsibilities beyond that to report, to monitor, to understand the risks, really. They may have some professional obligations to do with, you know, various professional bodies they belong to, but those aren't legally binding and sort of punishable if you get caught breaking them. It's a really important, it would plot two great big holes in the anti-money laundering architecture of the US. The Biden administration was moving these out and moving these forward. The Trump administration came in and decided they wanted to delay these. I believe the real estate rule will not come into effect until at least March 2026. And the investment advisor rule has been punted till at least January 2028. So really getting way into lame duck territory for the Trump administration there if they plan to bring it in at all. And in both cases, they say they want, which is not unreasonable for an incoming administration, they want to take a look and make sure that these rules, these new regulations are properly tailored to the industries that they address, and they're not creating undue burdens, administrative burdens, on businesses involved in that. And you know, I don't have a problem with that. You know, the question is, are we going to do that? Are we serious about that? I'm going to bring the law in, or are we just pursuing kind of a deregulatory thing, and we're going to keep punting it down the road until it's not our responsibility, and it, you know, it falls to the next administration to deal with it. So, Scott, I don't know if you had any other thoughts on that side of things.
Yeah, I mean, for the rest of the developed world, this has been an asked and answered question. I mean, the international body that looks at anti-money laundering and anti-corruption rules, the Financial Action Task Force, looked at, almost 100 countries, major economic centers, and the United States is basically the only one on that list. And I'm talking about, a list that includes China. That doesn't have anti-money laundering requirements for its four big sectors of, so it's real estate, it's accountants who manage people's money, it's lawyers who open up the trusts and the companies that work with these suspicious clients. And it's like the corporate service providers who provide those sort of similar services, serving as, agents of a corporation or on the board or registered agent, you name it. We are a global outlier at this point. I mean, we are literally 0 for 4 per FATF's assessment. And we've seen these examples. I mean, this is one of the things that hits middle America. There was a huge scandal in my hometown in Cleveland, where the largest commercial landlord in the city was a Ukrainian oligarch who, had stolen $4.5 billion from Ukraine's second largest bank. And he plowed a lot of that dirty money into the skyline in downtown Cleveland. Then the DOJ comes and goes after him for money laundering and tries to seize those assets, and those properties fall into disrepair. The community investment gets hollowed out. It has real downstream impacts for people who have jobs in a vulnerable part of the country. That's what this rule was designed to go after. It was supposed to make it so that if you are going to sell a high value property to someone, who basically shows up with a suitcase full of cash. So this is not when they get a mortgage through a bank. This is they're coming to you with cash and trying to buy a property. You have to do the same basic due diligence that a bank would do if you're opening up an account. So this is one of the biggest problems that the U.S. anti-money laundering regime had faced. We thought we were going to be there. We may still get there in March. I certainly hope we do. It is a national rule. So there is a bit of consideration and implementation, and I hope Nate's point about it's a new administration. They're just, trying to get their own assessment on this before moving forward. But this is a known huge gap in our safeguards here.
And if you go back to the Title 31, you put it right, Nate, in the beginning by saying we're looking at financial, normally this applies to financial institutions. That definition has been so stretched to include casinos, trust companies, insurance companies are already covered, right? Securities brokers and dealers. I mean, the list goes on. Telegraph companies, which I know they're all worried about, but businesses involved in vehicle sales. It's not what's a financial institution, it's what's at risk of luring or having people use that system, like, let's say, vehicle sales, to launder money. We all know it's true in real estate. We all know that investment advisors, lawyers, whatever, they can be just as involved in any of this. And the thing that concerns me when, Scott, you call us, the US is an outlier and the US is becoming more of an outlier by not dealing with the Corporate Transparency Act, by, reformulating, FCPA enforcement to focus on cartels and connections, and even down to the definition of financial institution and what risk entities should be included. And but I'm not so sure that, FATF's regulations, FATF's recommendations and studies, and when we get evaluated, I think we're gonna take some negative hits in for all of this.
And
And
they'll be on the ground here. The FATF team is already on the ground doing the fourth mutual evaluation for the United States right now. They'll be in DC and elsewhere in February. You know that they have these things at the top of their list, and there's a lot of concern that the US is going to get dinged significantly for these. Yeah.
And look, we know, I mean, I can cite cases in which large amounts of proceeds from corrupt officials were brought here to the U.S. and, you know, real estate, artwork, you know, New York was filled with it. Miami, as Nate said, that's where the risk areas are. And I just think that these are sort of basic elements that we need to put in place and should have in place. And particularly, I mean, these are not like small industries we're talking about. Real estate and investment advisors, I mean, they are handling lots and lots of money. They can accept, you know, they can have cash, they can, you know, whatever, suitcases full of cash. But the thing about it is they need to be held accountable under the Title 31 requirements. And that's, and it's simply to, you know, have an AML program in place and, you know, provide basic, you know, due diligence when you're onboarding people or doing business with them so that you document that. And if you see something suspicious, you report it under this. So it just doesn't seem to me to be, you know, such a heavy ask. But, you know, and Nate, I hear you on, you know, they should look it over. They get the right to look these over. I get that. That's true. They won the election. They get a right to look at it and make sure. I just hope it's not a subterfuge to, you know, delay and delay and ultimately kill. But we'll see. But you guys raised some great points on that. So let's turn to another area, which and perhaps, you know, is fast becoming even more at risk. And there doesn't seem to me to be the same considerations of consequences and impact on how the bad people can use cryptocurrency. And we've already heard, look, the most sophisticated cryptocurrency outfits in terms of moving money around seem to me to be North Korea and Russia. And in particular, North Korea has been able to evade sanctions and all of that through complex cryptocurrency schemes involving, again, shell companies without any sort of disclosure requirements. So, but we've had a lot of cryptocurrency, we've had some cryptocurrency legislation passed, but what are we looking at now, Scott, in terms of, I mean, it's a big issue, and I don't mean to just throw it on top of you, but I mean, this the cryptocurrency bill that passed, and then there's probably going to be another one, I would think, because people are hot to trot on this, and the Trump administration is very supportive of the industry.
Yeah, so I mean, big picture, the Trump administration said that it wanted to pass cryptocurrency legislation within the first 100 days or so of the administration taking office. There's been a ton of legislative activity on this front. So over the summer, Congress passed and President Trump signed into law something called the Genius Act, which is the first, you know, way of setting regulations, standards around stable coins, which are like the dollar denominated, you know, the value of a stable coin is tied to the value of the US dollar. And so it's designed to be a, you know, less volatile, safer investment, arguably. But, you know, we saw this legislation at first didn't include any anti-money laundering protection. So like, sure, the bigger players here, think like your Coinbase, your Bitcoin wallets, the big folks, the big exchanges, they are all treated right now under our anti-money laundering laws, where they have to have anti-money laundering safeguards. They have to do a lot of the same things that banks do. But there are tons of other players involved in this broader ecosystem, which is now what Congress is focusing on. There are two big bills that the Senate is negotiating as we speak that would go to the larger cryptocurrency landscape, so far, far beyond stable coins. We're talking about mixers. We're talking about decentralized finance or DeFi protocol. We're talking about like the bigger wallet infrastructure. If I have a wallet and I want to send money to someone else who has a wallet independent of an exchange, these are ways that bad actors can move billions of dollars, and it's growing every year. We know this. There's no customer checks. There's no record keeping. There's no suspicious activity reporting. You mentioned North Korea. the group there called the Lazarus Group laundered something like $600 million after a big hack. And they ran these funds through unregulated mixers, DeFi platforms, and they basically made the money disappear. There's no trail that law enforcement can go after. Our basic argument has been, and we're lucky to have worked with groups like Nate at the Hudson Institute and others, to just apply the same rules that anybody who's performing these kind of financial services, regardless of the, say, you know, the technology wrapper that it's in, it happens to be crypto, but you need to give Treasury the authority to go after these high-risk folks in that system, require anybody who's involved in these major access points to crypto to have the same AML protections that every bank would have. Until we do that, we're keeping the door open for North Korea, for Iran, for Russia. This is how Russia is evading so many of the sanctions that the United States has put on them and their currencies, to drug cartels, human traffickers, hostile foreign governments who are trying to get around the rules of the financial global road. This is the new frontier for how bad actors are being able to move their dirty money around the world. And if the U.S. is going to act, we know it's going to have ripple effects across the world. And we want to make sure that we get it right here at home. Because once Congress acts on something this size, they are not likely to revisit it for many years, decades to come. We got to get it right. We got to make sure we meet the risk where it's at and that we provide a helpful blueprint for other countries who are hoping to do the same.
After the Genius Act, I mean, there's obviously lots of bills pending. Do you feel like there's any momentum to get into this next year, Scott, or what do you see from, you know, your work on the Hill?
Yeah, I mean, so there are already bill texts, ideas, frameworks that have been put out by leadership in the Senate and on the House side, but the action's really in the Senate now. Unfortunately, we know that Senator Reid out of Rhode Island has been working on an AML for crypto bill that would accomplish a lot of this. It would close the AML gap, supply it to other players in the crypto landscape here. It would give clear sanctions authority to the Treasury to go after bad actors abroad. A lot of really good ideas in there. I think it's getting good support at this point. We may even see it come out in the next couple of weeks, but it's that kind of rallying point that folks on the Hill and groups like ours need to point to say, look, this is a serious risk. We've got folks who did the numbers here on how to address it. They could pass something in the next couple of months. I mean, this is initially, like we're talking about, something that was so high on the administration's agenda that leadership in Congress was getting a lot of pressure to get this done. And, you know, we could have a final, you know, law on the broader cryptocurrency ecosystem, you know, before 2026. And so we're really at this pivotal moment to try and work with our champions in Congress and others to make sure that they're baking these things into the cake.
Well, look, we'll watch over this. I mean, I just think there's a lot of momentum behind, you know, the word cryptocurrency and the fact that the administration is so, this is a high priority of them. Somebody's likely, whether they'll get to the, you know, enough weight to get it through, it'll be interesting. Let's turn to one other issue on, and I guess this, you guys pointed out this to me as a positive, and in terms of some foreign aid that was given, was passed and administered out to support the kleptocracy initiatives, which I think is terrific. I take it this was in the State Department. Was this the Authorization Act or was it the, the funding?
Yeah, I can give you a quick rundown on this. Yeah, so basically, folks who have been tracking what's going on in the foreign aid cuts, led by Elon Musk and Doge, they basically had zeroed out U.S. foreign aid. So we're talking about tens of billions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars historically that were going to address issues as widespread as, you know, health, public safety, I mean, the environmental protections, you name it. The U.S. is the single largest provider of foreign aid in the world. Hundreds of millions of dollars were going toward efforts in other countries to combat corruption, to build up the rule of law, to make a better, more competitive business landscape so, you know, American businesses can compete on an even playing field, to protect the victims of corruption, you know, everything from training a prosecutor in Mexico about how to go after drug cartels to sharing information that the United States collects on corrupt actors with other governments. You know, that was essentially zeroed out back in the spring. And so, you know, the State Department went back to the drawing board with Congress, and they said, what are our priorities and where are we going to put money in going forward? And we were really happy to see that in the State Department policy bill that was passed by Republicans in the House Foreign Affairs Committee, so the committee that works on these issues, they included language saying that it's going to be the policy of the United States going forward for foreign funding that goes abroad, to include, you know, dollars for anti-corruption and counter-kleptocracy efforts. You know, a lot of the same issues that previous foreign aid, you know, were given money to these programs, we now have from Republican leadership that in the future, when this foreign aid money is turned back on, fighting corruption and kleptocracy around the world is still going to be part of that framework. And I'll tell you, in an environment where funding for so many other important recipients of foreign aid has just been decimated, we are incredibly encouraged to see that this remains a bipartisan issue and that there's going to be a future investment possible.
And Nate, you had mentioned the Hudson Institute and the work you are doing on kleptocracy. Obviously, that was probably a welcome development. What do you see in terms of the next, you know, year coming up? As we wind down 2025, get into 2026, but what are the Hudson Institute, you know, what are your priorities? Where are you going to focus? I don't want you to reveal any of your trade secrets, you know, where do you put your resources in? Because I get the impression that you work closely with Scott at Transparency International. There's other, obviously, organizations that would be part of that coalition. But what's high on your priority list, or what, you know, in terms of trying to get things done?
Well, my priority list is, you know, we focus very much on U.S. adversaries and their sort of malign influence around the world and the way it undermines U.S. interests. We've already mentioned the DOGE cuts, where much of the foreign aid budget and a lot of U.S. global engagement was really just chopped off overnight. Without much thought or examination for what the implications might be. I spend a lot of my time looking at how China's Belt and Road Initiative has really turbocharged corruption and kleptocracy in key countries that should be partners all around the world. For those who may not be familiar, this is China's $1 trillion global infrastructure investment plan. There's 140 countries now where it's present. They've been building highways, they've been building dams, you know, water treatment facilities, you name it. Critical infrastructure that gives them a strategic foothold in all these countries. And unlike Western, donor funding, you know, from like the IMF or the World Bank or the US directly, China comes along with secret contracts and no conditions whatsoever for the investment that they'll be making, but it is lending. So there are two effects of that. One, all the secrecy around these deals sort of tends to attract, you know, bribery, embezzlement, corruption, incentivizes it. So it's turbocharged corruption, as I said, in 140 countries around the world. And the problem with this is that the US has really taken a step back this year by cutting off not just the conventional stuff that we think of, like reducing FCPA enforcement, the foreign aid cuts, the kind of things we were doing, like training judges in vulnerable societies and things like that to spot those kinds of corruption cases, but also things like state-funded broadcasting organizations like Radio Free Asia, Radio Free Europe, Voice of America. These were really important ways that citizens within China even, but also in countries affected by corruption that was carried along on the Belt and Road Initiative, really important ways that they were finding out about this corruption through the reporting done by it. And that has not only disappeared, but China has bought up all the broadcasting slots in most countries that they have vacated. So they're now just hearing Chinese propaganda about how corrupt America is as it tries to do business, as American companies do try to do business around the world. So restoring, in the short answer, the too long don't read, is kind of restoring, finding ways to restore and revitalize our ways of communicating about corruption and anti-corruption around the world in a way that will benefit us in the strategic competition we find ourselves in with China. And that is an existential struggle, in my view.
You know, and the initiative you're talking about seems to me, we heard a lot about it. I was going to say there, I thought that the China initiative has had a significant impact in Africa. And these are, governments that, like Sudan, whatever, that where corruption is just ripe to occur. And we've heard a lot about that initiative, and it does seem like the United States has pulled back some from, supporting some of their interests and our interests in Africa as the economies develop there. And is that still true of the China initiative, that it's targeted somewhat towards Africa and the developing countries there?
Not just Africa. It really is a global kind of influence operation at this point. Certainly it is, it's in Africa. African countries often particularly, they have enormous needs when it comes to investment, not only in infrastructure, but all sorts of things. Overwhelmingly, there are authoritarian regimes that don't like being lectured by Western donors. So they find these partnerships with Chinese state-owned companies and the Chinese government very appealing, because they'll often come along with, whereas the Russians will tend to go in with offers of, security assurances. So they'll provide mercenaries to prop up the regime as part of business deals. The Chinese will often offer what they have to, so sort of surveillance equipment. So is one example, and ways that they can further repress their own societies. So it's really pernicious, and it has really gathered steam. Africa is certainly feeling is certainly in the grip of that. But, China also has a very strong foothold across Latin America, which, you'd think would be a real priority and a concern for this administration, which has very obviously making Latin America a priority. But China's number one goal, is always its own periphery. And so Southeast Asia will always bear the brunt of its, the most intense efforts. But, you see bribery cases across Europe as well now. So the Chinese machine, we often think, Russia is the archetypal kleptocracy, and it has the most spectacular kind of bribery cases and whatnot. But the kind of corrupt practice that China exports from its own system as it grows in its global engagement, it grows as a global economic power, are far more corrosive in the long term, I think. And they are the ones that we will really struggle to compete against in the long term, because when China corrupts local elites, they no longer are reliable security partners for the US. They're no longer, US businesses are not going to be able to compete against Chinese state-backed companies, even if they don't have FCPA being enforced against them. They just don't have the money that Chinese state-backed companies do to go in. So yes, Africa very much in the crosshairs, but I really wouldn't limit it. It's a global campaign.
Yeah, I was not aware of the impact in Latin America, the Chinese sort of initiative, and obviously in countries in Asia for their own reasons. But listen, Nate, Scott, terrific conversation. Is there anything, Scott, you want to offer as we close out? And hopefully we'll be back soon with good news, more good news. Okay.
Yeah, I appreciate it, Michael. Thanks for the opportunity to give an update here across the board. The only other thing I'd flag quickly is we've talked about so many of the sectors that have gaps here, real estate, investment advisors, what have you. There has been some good momentum when it comes to going after the intermediaries who are selling art. It's another big dimension of the U.S. financial system. People who are selling high-value paintings, sculptures, etc., they are another one of these classic tributaries that corrupt and other, criminal organizations use to launder their money. This goes back to, Scarface, and you want to plow your trafficking of drug money. What do? You buy the big Monet that you hang up in your living room. Those folks didn't have any prerequisites about what they had to make sure about their clients, the flag, if it was maybe dirty money. And we just saw a couple months ago a group of six senators, three Republicans, three Democrats, that put out a bill that would fix this. Nate just hosted a great conversation about it a couple weeks ago at Hudson. You know, this is a potentially bright spot that we could really start moving and getting behind early
next year. It's always good when you have a bipartisan group like that. In other words, if you have a group of senators, you know, Republicans and Democrats, that's a good sign that there may be some momentum to build there. So that's great. And I'm glad to see the Hudson Institute, you know, hosting something like that. That's got to be very helpful. So, all right, gentlemen, and I use that term loosely sometimes when I'm referring to myself as well. And I wanted to thank you so much for joining us. And we'll definitely check back. You know, there's always developments going on in this field. And Scott and Nate, keep up the incredible work that you do. And if anybody, let's take a moment, if you guys don't mind, giving out some contact information in case anybody wants to reach you to help or to discuss any of these issues and try to link up somehow. So go ahead if you can.
Yeah, I mean, you can find us, our website's a great place to start, us.transparency.org. If you're on X, you can find us at Transparency USA. We give regular updates about the work we're doing, the campaigns we're engaged on, how folks can get involved. I appreciate the opportunity to have the conversation, Michael. Great to be with you all.
And Nate, if somebody wants to reach out to you or to the Hudson Institute, what's the best way to get?
Yeah, likewise. Unfortunately, I'd love to give my email out, but we get cyber attacked by China and Russia and Iran all the time at Hudson. So I'm going to direct you to our website and our contact form, and I assure you it will reach me. But so Hudson.org, and you'll find all of our work on there as well.
Fantastic. Thank you again, you guys. And we will be back soon in the coming months. And have a good holiday, and we'll see you next year.
Thanks, Michael.